Hi, this is Tobin Beck from Concordia University, and I'm here today with Tim Gegline. Welcome, Tim.
Thank you. It's great to be with you.
And Tim is Vice President for External Affairs for Focus on the Family in Washington, and also is a former advisor to President George W. Bush. Tell us a little bit about Focus on the Family, about what the organization is, what it does, and in particular, what you're doing.
Well, Focus on the Family is one of my favorite topics. Focus on the Family was founded in Southern California 41 years ago by Dr. James Dobson. And Dr. Dobson was a graduate of USC, a native of California. And in the 1960s and 70s, he was noticing that there were a number of issues in American culture that were impacting faith, marriage, family, and parenting. And of course, as we know now, America lived through a moral and social upheaval, a moral and social revolution in the 60s and 70s that then and now have had massive implications for these issues. And so over the years, Focus on the Family grew from being a one-person operation to a 10-person operation to a 30-person operation. And now, all these years later, I have about 700 colleagues. And we are also very busy internationally. Focus on the Family has a presence in over 130 countries. We have a public policy division. We have a broadcast division. Focus on the Family is heard by about 7 million people a week. It's one of the most popular Christian radio programs in the country. We have a pro-life division. We have a pro-marriage division called Hope Restored. We have a division at Focus on the Family that works on adoption, orphan care, foster care. We have one of the most prominent pro-life centers, as it were, in the country. Something called Option Ultrasound, which is one of the most important pro-life provisions in the history of the country since 1973, when Roe versus Wade made abortion legal in all 50 states. And I could go on and on. Focus, if it concerns healthy marriage, family, parenting, pro-life, religious liberty, orphan care, foster care, adoption, helping to restore marriages that are having problems, people who want good counsel and good advice, who are having problems with children, grandchildren, substance abuse issues have become a very important part of our ministry at Focus. All of the above constitutes just some of what we do.
And when we talked earlier, you mentioned faith, your faith, you've grown up as a Lutheran, and faith is central to your life. Can you talk about that?
Yes, thank you. I am a cradle Lutheran. I was born and raised in Fort Wayne, Indiana. I'm very happy to say my parents are still there. Much of my extended family still lives there. And, I don't mind saying it, next to my wife, my parents are my best friends. And I was raised in a Christian home, and I was raised by parents who really modeled a loving, committed relationship and marriage. I have two brothers and a sister, and we were raised in a home where family and marriage was very central to the way that we grew up, and the faith of our parents and involvement in our church and in our parish, very central to the way that we grew up. And we had and have a very remarkable extended family where we love and care for one another, honor and esteem one another. It's a large family, which means that no family is perfect. It means that families have distinctions, and we have different views, and we have all the things that all contemporary families have. At the center of it is a real commitment to honoring and esteeming our parents, finding plenty of room to love and to support one another and into the next generations, wonderful nieces, nephew. And I'm very happy to say that the center for my wife, Jenny, and me, and for our sons is our love for Jesus Christ. It's a very special relationship. And the idea of the sacraments, the word and the sacraments and our relationship with God is very central in the way that my wife and I think about marriage, the way that we've raised our sons, Tim and Paul. And I'm crazy about my wife. She has sacrificed everything for me. And Jenny, she's the love of my life.
No, that sounds great. Similar situation with my family, my wife, Ellen, our son, Jonathan, JT.
Yes.
So, yes, I certainly can relate to what you're saying. You've had quite a career, and more than 30 years, is it, in Washington? And mixing your relationship with faith, with the church, with politics and government. Can you talk a little bit about your background and the things that you've been involved with?
Thank you. In the summer of 1985, I was a student at Indiana University in Bloomington. And I know that there are a lot of Christians listening to us. And we know that in the Christian life, many of the things that we plan for are expressly the things that don't happen. And the things that we really don't anticipate, those are the ones that happen. I'm a believer in what Ronald Reagan called the DP, the divine plan, you know, that God's in the details, and that we all have a vocation, and that we're meant to do something that is unique in our relationship with Jesus Christ. And when I was a student at Indiana University, I received a call almost out of the blue from a woman who was very involved in politics. And she said, I really think you ought to apply for an internship this summer in the U.S. Senate, which I did. And I ended up getting that internship for then U.S. Senator Dan Quayle of Indiana, who was one of the youngest senators in the Senate at the time. And I had a wonderful summer. And the next summer, I interned for another Dan Coates of Indiana, who was an even more obscure Dan from Northeast Indiana, member of the House of Representatives. Providence cleared his throat, you know, a year and a half later, and Dan Quayle, out of obscurity, became the Vice President of the United States of America, and Dan Coates became the U.S. Senator, taking Dan Quayle's place. And Dan Coates called me, and he said, I remember the internship that you did in my office. I know that you're a journalism graduate, and I need someone to help me in radio and television. And so I moved to Washington and became his deputy press secretary and served him the entire time he was in the Senate as deputy press secretary, and then communications manager. And when he retired, I thought, I'm done with politics. And he said, you know, you're making a mistake. He said, you've worked this long at this end of Constitution Avenue. You ought to serve in one presidential campaign. And I took his counsel and did. And it was fun. I enjoyed it. But it didn't work out. You know, we got to the New Hampshire primary, and the candidate that I was working for didn't go any further. And I thought, well, I've done the Iowa caucuses, I've done the New Hampshire primary, that's American politics at its finest, on to the next thing. And I received a call from then Governor George W. Bush's staff, and they said, we'd like to have you come to Austin, Texas, and to join the campaign, which I did. And my wife and I and our boys were 2 and 4 then. We moved to Austin, joined the campaign, 32 days in Florida during Bush v. Gore. George W. Bush was declared the winner. And again, providentially, I was asked to become a special assistant to the president. And I served for nearly 8 years in the White House. And as I've written about in a book, I had all of the, by God's grace alone, the highest highs you could have. I mean, it was a remarkable experience. And I had the lowest lows. I had remarkable personal failure, all of my own doing, and it was the undoing of me professionally. And because of my actions and because of my choices, I was foisted into a crisis of very important proportions. And I've written about this.
Can you talk a little bit about how that happened? You're talking about the plagiarism issues with columns that you were writing for newspaper back home in Indiana.
That's right. I'm honored that you would ask, because as a result of this crisis, I made a personal commitment that I would share this story in the hopes that I might minister to other people. And I've come to see over time that the immediate issue was plagiarism, which I'm going to mention and talk about. But it was really something much deeper. It was a very deep sense of pride, which is a toxic and acidic sin. And if pride is not dealt with very directly, it pervades every part of a person's life. And I had been asked by the editor of one of the newspapers in my hometown to write a guest column. And he said, write about anything you want, but don't write about politics. He said, I know you're in politics. We do lots of politics on the editorial page. Write about all the things you're interested in, the American Songbook, tennis, jazz, the Chicago Cubs, what you're reading, poetry, opera, which I did. I wrote about everything. So here's my confession. My confession is that I felt that I was a competent writer, you know, but I wasn't F. Scott Fitzgerald, you know, I wasn't Ernest Hemingway. And I began knowingly plagiarizing columns for the New Sentinel. It wasn't that I was too busy. It wasn't that there were other extenuating circumstances. I knew exactly what I was doing, and I did it anyway. And in the eighth year, when I was serving in the White House, I came back from a breakfast meeting, and a reporter sent me an email saying, did you plagiarize that column? And I don't mind telling you that if I have forgotten the words of every prayer I've ever offered, if I live to be 1,000, I'll never forget the prayer that I prayed at that moment. And it's a very simple prayer. It goes like this, oh God, oh God, because it was true. And it wasn't only true about plagiarizing one column, I had plagiarized several columns. And that day, I did the most difficult thing that I've ever had to do, which is that I resigned my commission to the president. And I slunk out of the White House, if that's a word. And I began to find that it was not an issue of plagiarism per se. It was certainly that. But it was other things. It was this idea of being prideful, of being haughty, of being arrogant, a feeling that it wasn't just good enough to be a good or a competent or an interesting writer. It was that I had to be the greatest, the best. And, you know, in Washington, I'm sure in other places as well, it's, you know, the avenues of pride are sex, power, and money. And with me, it was wanting to be Cicero, and I wasn't. And I went through a remarkable crisis. I learned that plagiarism is a form of deception. And in the Christian life, prideful people find the ability to mask this form of deception. This is what all prideful people have in common. And it ends up hurting other people in very large quotients. And I repented of my sin. And I began a process by God's grace alone to turn in a new direction.
So in your internal conversations with yourself and in your conversations with God, what do you do to keep yourself in that direction and not fall back into doing something like that again?
I remember, thank you for that question. I remember during this whole process, I had the best colleagues in the world, remarkable friends, wonderful family members. And, you know, they know that you're hurting and they know you're in a crisis. And so they say things to minister to you and they're very sincere. And one of the things that people would say is you have to forgive yourself. You know, you can redeem yourself, right? And what I came to learn, and I, you know, spent a lot of time with my pastor, and I spent a lot of time with a small group of fellow Christians. What I found is that we can't redeem ourselves, that only Jesus Christ can redeem us, but that it's very important that we confess our sin and that we remain accountable with people who are truly friends of ours by routinely checking in, by routinely being a part of our life, by having a license in the best sense to ask not the easy questions, but the difficult questions. So it's a process. And I have found I must tell you, I was so deeply impacted by the reading of the poetry of the Christian poet T.S. Eliot. And in one of his poems in the Four Quartets, largely considered to be a central part of his great achievement, there's a remarkable line, and it's actually quite simple, but it's not simplistic. And the line is that humility is endless. there's real power in humility, that humility is something that we foster, and that humility can be and should be the seedbed of the way that we as Christians relate to one another and relate to the world. And it's modeled, of course, by our Lord and Savior. And this, Tobin, has been a great blessing to me over and over again.
That's great how you witness with that.
Thank you.
I want to ask you about what you touched on earlier about Christians and public policy, and if you can speak a little bit about some of the issues that you're working on now and that you've been involved in.
You know, Christians and public life have been a part of our country since before there was a country. You know, it's easy to forget that you know, there were colonies and, you know, the presence of large numbers of what we now call Americans, you know, 150 years before the Constitution and the Declaration of Independence. And it would be almost impossible to understand the development of, the creation of, the United States of America apart from the centrality of the Judeo and Christian tradition. And over time and through my public life, I have read deeply, learned, been blessed immeasurably by scholars, thinkers, writers on this remarkable connection between faith and the public square and the proper way, the biblical way in which to integrate those two things. And I don't mind telling you, Tobin, that it's a very difficult nexus, because the church is not the state and the state is not the church. And, you know, this powerful, powerful scene in the New Testament where Jesus himself is holding a coin, looking at the visage of Caesar, right? And he makes it very clear that we are to give to the state what or government what it is owed. But we are to serve the church and give to the church what it is owed, and they are not the same thing. And what I have found over years, people of all faith backgrounds, people of goodwill, want something great for the country, and they have a view that at some point, this combination of someone riding a white horse, you know, with a copy of the Constitution in one hand and the Holy Bible in the other, is going to, you know, sort of proverbially, right, ride up Constitution Avenue and, in air quotation marks, save the country. And this is born not of someone who's being simplistic, but of someone who cares very deeply for the country, who wants something great for the country, and who knows that this idea of a return to biblical values as the sort of North Star, right, of character, integrity, ethics in public life, in Washington, and far beyond the Beltway. This is, I think, what people are hungry for. But it's the integration of where and how we as Christians are to serve the country, but to understand that the church and government are not the same thing, and most importantly, that they have very distinct roles and they have very distinct duties.
Right. Luther's doctrine of the two kingdoms.
Absolutely right. The kingdom of the left, the kingdom of the right, the kingdom of the state, the kingdom of the church. As I said earlier, you know, this unusual relationship, euphemistically, between what's called Athens and Jerusalem, right? Mm-hmm. Athens, the great model of civic life, of government, of great conversation, of public policy, and the idea of Jerusalem, which is revelation, which is the church, which is scripture, a sovereign God. These two great cities of Western civilization, I think, embody the tension in Western civilization and in American life between these two distinct bodies, the church and the government, which actually create a, you know, when they're doing what they are supposed to do best, they create the kind of tension, that, but it's a good kind of tension, that gives us a healthy culture. And what has happened is that government, over time, has taken upon itself the ability to step into the role historically of the church and to make particular decisions. And I think people of faith have said, must we really be limited by that? Does the government really have that power or that authority? And similarly, people in government have said, but does the church have that role? Is that really the role of where the church should be? And I think these are eternal questions. I think they're important questions. And I think that, you know, in America, this exceptional, extraordinary country, we are at the end of the day a religious republic. But the government is not a church.
But what does that mean? And how do people of good faith sort that out?
I think that's the largest historical question. And I think it goes back in a very profound way to the founding of the country. You had these remarkably different men and women. There's Thomas Jefferson. There's John Adams. There's Abigail Adams. There's Martha Washington. There is Benjamin Rush. And there's Benjamin Franklin. You know, it's so easy and it's tempting to say, well, the founding generation, they all agreed on all the most important issues. And what you learn by a very quick read of American history, much less a read has more depth, is that we create cartoons and stereotypes over the founding generation. The fact is, they disagreed on the biggest issues you could possibly disagree about. Slavery, a full-time military, a national bank, it goes on and on. One thing that they mostly did not disagree about is they did not disagree about the fact that if you wanted to have liberty and freedom over many years in a concept of self-government, that the government could never impose a standard of ethics. And so they asked rightfully, in the American experience, where does that quotient of virtue and moral excellence come from that's so necessary in the leaders and in the people? You know, how do you create good citizens? And they learned in the Roman model that you could cease being a republic with a lot of freedom and you could become an empire. You could cease to become a citizen and you could become a subject. And our founding fathers and mothers were preoccupied by this question. And they said and wrote about and advocated that in American public life, they wanted a large swath for the Christian and the Jewish ideal.
But without becoming either a Christian or a Jewish government or nation.
Absolutely right. And in fact, neither John Adams nor Thomas Jefferson were at the Constitutional Convention. Adams was our ambassador to the Court of St. James in London. Jefferson, of course, was in Paris. But when both men, who were they were great friends, but they had great differences on big issues, but neither could ultimately support the Constitution without a guarantee that there would be a Bill of Rights. And to your very point, it's not a coincidence that even though it was not drafted first, it became our First Amendment. They wanted no established church, which is to say they did not want, in the European model, a Catholic church, as in France, or an Anglican church, as in England, the concept of orthodoxy in Russia. What they wanted was they wanted no national church, that in a constitutional republic where self-government was the first liberty, they wanted a wide swath and a lot of room for a thriving civil society led by the church. Now, there is a caveat. Many of the 13 original states had strong state churches that were actually funded by taxpayers. But at a federal, national level, they definitively wanted no established church. And I think that was a brilliant decision.
Well, which puts, as you think about it, puts responsibility back on citizens for carrying through with the idea of what the ethics, the standards are, and invests in them responsibility for ensuring that the government follows along.
May I tell you, I have a colleague at Focus on the Family, and I'm on a different college campus about every 2 and 3 weeks. And my colleague had noticed that over the last 2 years, I've been visiting the Concordias, and especially as a Lutheran, I'm very rightfully proud of the Concordia system. And she asked me, when you go to the Concordias, what is it that really attracts you about being there? And just earlier today, I was privileged to have lunch with some of the students. And I was reconfirmed again in the answer that I gave to my colleague, which is that one of the things that the Concordias do so well is we focus like a laser beam on the moral formation of young people, which gives to us great citizens. And this is a very important metric about what is the purpose of an education. You can go to any number of colleges, universities, 2-year, 4-year, etc. But not every college or university focuses like a laser beam on the making of good citizens. This is something that I believe that Concordia does particularly well. It asks big questions. What makes for good citizens? What are the duties of good citizens? The first duty of being a Christian, right, in a constitutional republic is to vote. And yet large percentages of fellow brothers and sisters in Christ don't vote. As I say, that's the first duty of Christian citizenship, whether in the United States or in France or wherever it is. More importantly, what does it actually mean to be a citizen? What are our duties and obligations? I'm not sure that we ask that question enough of our young people. Another part of it, and this is something else that I love about Concordia, is its commitment to the first principles of this hinge of history between the young Christian citizen, the liberal arts, and being prepared to take your position to be a leader in the country. Not everyone's vocation is a pastor or a missionary. It might be teaching. It might be the law. It might be politics. It might be business. It might be whatever. But these first unchanging, unwavering principles are very central. And in a constitutional republic, it's very important that before these young people graduate, that they've been exposed to the United States Constitution, to the Declaration of Independence, to the Federalist Papers, to democracy in America, and to have some sense about uniquely what does it mean in America to be a Lutheran Christian or a man or woman of faith, and the way that we're supposed to look at the public square and do things that serve Christ and his kingdom. And I think this is one of the great things that Concordia can do by serving its students to say, how do we apply this worldview, this uniquely differentiated Lutheran worldview, how do we apply it to being Christians in 21st century America? And the beautiful thing is, Luther is so great that it applies directly.
Well said. So, any final thoughts on wrapping up our interview?
I would say the following. Lutheran education is a remarkable gift to the United States of America. We have the second largest parochial school system. We have these remarkable colleges and universities. We have two seminaries. We have a historic association based in St. Louis. We have large numbers of men and women who are Lutherans who have made these incredible contributions to the country, including the man who was the first Speaker of the House. And you say, well, that's only a synod, the Missouri Synod, of less than 3 million people. I mean, it's remarkable what this relatively small number of like-minded men and women built around the theology of word and sacrament in the Lutheran tradition have actually contributed to our country, our culture, and our civilization. And, being here on this campus, this beautiful campus, I say to myself, these young people, they're only half of our population, but they're 100% of the future. And the ability to impact and shape those young lives for good ends and good purposes, for vocation, right? Luther's great contribution on vocation, I think is just one of the great blessings of being a Lutheran in America. And I have a love affair with America, but it comes from my vantage view, first and foremost, as a passionate follower of Jesus Christ in the Lutheran tradition.
Well, thank you very much for being with us today. I'm Tobin Beck with Tim Gagline. Thank you for listening.